Welcome to I Want What She Has. Manuel says it so much better if you're listening to Warren's show. I want what she has. This is Teresa, your host. This is a show that seeks to amplify women's voices and their stories. I'm happy to be back in the station this week. I've been traveling. Thanks for tuning in to the great interviews that I had playing the past few weeks. I'm excited to be back here and talking today with, first off, Dr. Amy Novat. She has been on the show in the past. For anyone who's been tuning in, she's a gynecologist here in the Hudson Valley, and she is taking your calls. So for those of you who have questions out there about women's health, you can call the station. And I'll tell you the number again later, but it's 845-331-1490. So you can call in and ask the doctor your questions. If not, I'm going to monopolize the time with her and talk about perimenopause. And so that's for the first half an hour of the show. And then around 1:30, if you're listening real time or 30 minutes into the show, I will be speaking in depth with Aaron Dyer, who is a musician. I'll get more into Aaron's background a little bit later in the show, but she is performing as part of the upcoming O Positive Festival that is happening in 2 weekends. You're performing Saturday night, right? Saturday?
Yes.
Yes. BSP.
Yes. Yes. Back room.
Yes. The back room. And so we're going to talk about, she's a part of several different musical groups, but she is performing with Drone Choir at the O Positive Festival. So we're going to talk about that plus lots of other things. And in the meantime, Aaron's going to be here with me talking to the doctor.
Yeah. Watching you talk to the doctor.
All right. I hope that all made sense and came out properly. I did arrive back late last night, and after my flight was canceled, and it was a long day of traveling. We left Morocco Monday morning, flew to Spain, sat there for 6 hours at a layover, boarded the plane at 8:25 p.m. on a Monday night, sat on the plane for 3 hours, and then they decided to cancel the flight, and then waited at the airport until 2:30 in the morning to be transported to a hotel, and then got up the next morning and went back to the airport, which we were fortunate enough to get a flight out that day because most other people waited 2 days. So thank you, whoever was watching out for me there. So I'm back. I'm here. And is the doctor on the phone yet? Dr. Novat.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So for those of you who are not familiar, Dr. Novat is a gynecologist here and a women's health advocate, I like to think of, here in the Hudson Valley. And she's been so gracious to give us her time a couple of times throughout this year to talk women's health. And so if you do have a question for the doctor, you can call us here at Radio Kingston. The number is 845-331-1490. And so as we're waiting for anybody who might have a question to call in, I talked to the doctor beforehand about maybe bringing up the great subject of perimenopause, which is something that I've actually kind of like strangely tried to avoid because I'm in denial about the fact that it's approaching or I may be in it. And I know that we have actually talked about it a little bit. Maybe we've talked about, I may have asked about menopause, and you have explained the proper definitions of these things for us, doctor. And so I'm wondering if we could maybe start with that. The definition of menopause, and then what is perimenopause?
Sure, thank you. So these words are often used interchangeably, and they are quite different. The menopause is literally the last menstrual period that a woman experiences. And so we only know when we've had our menopause, when we look back and it's been a year without a period. Then we call that last menstrual period a year ago, whatever date, as the menopause. In contrast, the perimenopause is a time frame described by hormonal tonal shifts. So people will often describe changes in the way they feel or changes in the way their periods are being experienced. Usually it happens or starts happening in the 40s and can last from everything from a few months to actually up to 10 years. And this is the time prior to that last menstrual period, or again, the menopause, where hormones are beginning to shift. Specifically, what's happening is that our progesterone levels are beginning to drop. Our estrogen levels are pretty stable, but it's the ratio, the comparison or the relationship of estrogen and progesterone that begins to change. And so women can experience a whole array of symptoms as a result of these change in hormones.
This is probably going to be one of those difficult questions, but you've mentioned, you know, that it typically happens in the 40s. I've heard people talk about you know, it happening much earlier than that. And does the medical community have any kind of idea about why it can vary so greatly?
None. It is as individual as hair type and other differences that we all have as individual women. There probably is a genetic component to it. It is not always true, but some women will say, oh, my mother had her last menstrual period at 53, so did my older two sisters, and I'm approaching 53, and I haven't had a period in quite a while. So there is a genetic propensity. Probably there's an impact on stress. Women will lose their periods when certain events happen in their lives. Certainly if they undergo chemotherapy, they may have an early menopause. Women who have been under terrible stressors like war have described the loss of their periods. Even women undergoing very difficult life experiences like divorce or the loss of a parent or the loss of a child can describe all of a sudden that they have no periods. So there are these stressors. But other than that, we don't have any understanding of why some women might be as young as 40 having their last menstrual period, or someone as old as 59 having her last menstrual period. It is not clear to us.
I'm not going to open up the can of worms, which is the question that I want to ask about. You know, if there should be more funds spent on understanding women's bodies and their functioning, we'll maybe leave that for another day. But I do know that we have a woman, Linda, on the phone who would like to ask a question. So I'll pause my questioning and we'll turn it over to Linda. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm so glad you're talking about menopause, because I have a question for you. I have menopause very bad. I have hot flashes so bad where it drives me nuts. Now, I don't know why I'm still having them, because I had a hysterectomy after I had my son, because I hemorrhage, whatever you call that. But the hot flashes are so bad where I have to keep my air conditioner on 24 hours a day. I asked my doctor to give me something, and he said that what he wanted to give me could cause me to have cancer, cause me to have a heart attack. Now, so what is it I can do? And I mean, it's also making me very rude, very, you know, hyper. And that's not me. And it's getting worse. And he refuses to give me anything.
Thank you for your question, Linda, and I'm sorry that you're experiencing that. This is something that I think I've heard pretty regularly, and it brings up a question that I have about hormone replacement therapy, mm-hmm. But I'll let Dr. Novat address your question.
Okay. Good afternoon, Linda. Thank you for calling.
Good afternoon, Doctor. How are you?
Fine, thank you. So I am also sorry to hear that you're struggling like you are.
Oh, I'm struggling with something terrible. This is not me acting the way, you know, the sweats and being miserable and being hateful. I'm usually a nice person, but husband Linda, says, oh, if they don't do something with that menopause, would you?
The first thing I would recommend is getting a second opinion from another physician, because it doesn't sound like your physician is truly hearing the intensity of your symptoms.
Okay.
Two, that there are several different ways in which we approach treating symptoms like hot flushes. So for all the other listeners, hot flushes or night sweats, these are experiences that women will have during the perimenopause and into the postmenopause, so that time frame after the last menstrual period.
Well, that's another question I have for you. I'm 73 years old. Should I still be having this?
So there is a group of about 15% of all women who will have hot flushes until the day they pass. Many of those women, they have lesser symptoms, but it sounds like, Linda, you are one of those women who just remains very difficult. So let's just talk about the different treatments that are out there, and then I'm just going to focus on the hormone replacement therapy question. So there is hormone replacement therapy, which is a combination of estrogen and progesterone. For someone who's had a hysterectomy like yourself, you would actually only need...
Dr. Nova, I'm just going to interrupt you. Linda, there's some background.
No, I got it. I took care of it.
Okay, because we can just mute your phone and then we'll...
No, I can hear you now. I was just doing something I shouldn't have been doing. Go ahead.
So there is a combined hormone replacement therapy, which is a combination of estrogen and progesterone. When a woman has had a hysterectomy, she only needs estrogen. These are the two hormones that, again, as I mentioned, are starting to change and then are significantly changed once you've had your last menstrual period, where there's a decrease in estrogen and progesterone. So we will sometimes treat people, women with hot flushes, for example, with hormone replacement therapy. We can also use medicines that are typically used for depression, medicines called SSRIs or a medicine called Effexor. And interestingly enough, these medicines can also reduce hot flushes. There are a variety of other medicines, herbs, and other approaches like homeopathy and acupuncture that can also assist.
Oh, really?
But let's talk about hormone replacement therapy. So hormone therapy, am I still there?
Yep, you're there.
Okay. Hormone replacement therapy has been utilized by women for many, many decades, actually since I think it started back in the 50s. And we used to use very high dosages of estrogen and progesterone, and there were some studies that showed that there were risks associated with them. And then in about 2002, the Women's Health Initiative showed that there were risks of heart disease, stroke, breast cancer, blood clots, liver and gallbladder changes associated with the combined use of estrogen and progesterone. And at that time, gosh, every magazine had a headline that all women should go off hormone replacement therapy, and they described it as the greatest evil. And then, of course, with a little bit of time, more and more science was done to investigate whether this was true or not. And what the subsequent studies have shown is that yes, there is a slight increased risk of heart disease, breast cancer, stroke, blood clots, liver and gallbladder changes when women use combined estrogen progesterone for over 5 years, but that those risks tend to be quite small. And so if a woman is really suffering, then we usually feel, depending upon a woman's history, that the benefits outweigh the risks. Now, some women have medical complications or conditions that keep us from giving them hormone replacement therapy. So if someone comes in with a very significant heart health issue or have had blood clots that went from their legs to their heart and the lungs, we will not give them hormone replacement therapy because it's too risky for that individual. But in general, we feel that hormone replacement therapy can be quite helpful for people and the risks are small. Also, with someone like yourself, Linda, who's had a hysterectomy, you're going to take estrogen only. And the science suggests that the estrogen only is even safer. So those risks that I've just listed, those risks are even smaller with estrogen alone. So again, I would suggest to you that you might have a conversation with a different gynecologist. You would certainly need someone to investigate what your medical history is and make sure that you are eligible for all these options. And then talk about the risks and the benefits of each and the potential side effects so that you can make an educated decision about how to treat your hot flushes. There's no reason you have to be suffering like you are.
Thank you, Doctor. This is Teresa, if that's not obvious to everyone. But I was curious to know if you said that if you're giving, I guess I'm just confused because you're saying to give estrogen only might be the route that some people go. But if the progesterone is what is actually diminishing, then I'm curious as to what if the estrogen only is just for somebody who's had an hysterectomy.
Pardon me, I wasn't really clear because we've been talking about the peri and the postmenopause. Linda is in the postmenopause.
Yeah.
And when in the postmenopause, both estrogen and progesterone are both diminished.
Okay.
And so a woman with a uterus, if she's going to take hormone replacement therapy, has to take both because there's very good science that shows that if you take estrogen only in the postmenopause and you still have a uterus, that estrogen can build up the lining of the uterus, called the endometrium, inappropriately. In fact, can create or increase the risk of endometrial or uterine cancer. But if you combine the estrogen and the progesterone together, then that risk is essentially eliminated.
I gotcha.
So in the perimenopause, when women are still having menstrual cycles. Maybe they're missing months. Maybe they're having monthly cycles, but they're beginning to have hot flushes. Or maybe they're beginning to feel some vaginal changes. Or maybe they're beginning to have mood changes or sleep interruption. Then those women typically have estrogen that's, you know, again, quite normal, but it's the progesterone that's starting to diminish. So for that woman, the hormones that may be given to her may just be progesterone, or may be given, estrogen and progesterone are sometimes given in that situation as well, but in a very different, with a different approach. That's not really called hormone replacement therapy in the same way we use it in the postmenopause.
Gotcha. Okay. I mean, I think I've got it. It's kind of complex.
It is complex because, you know, everyone, again, has different medical histories, situations in the perimenopause, and not everyone responds to these medications in the same way. So it's looking at the individual. It's looking at their history, their family history. Are there significant cancers that we worry about that being repeated? So you have to take a look at the whole picture before you make a good decision with a patient about what the right approach might be.
Okay, Teresa here with I Want What She Has, and we're talking to Dr. Amy Novat, a gynecologist who practices here in the Hudson Valley, and she is taking your calls. If you have a specific question that you'd like to ask the doctor, you can call us 845-331-1490. We have been talking about menopause and perimenopause, but your question does not have to be on just those things. And I'm sitting here in the radio station with Aaron Dyer, who is going to be, we'll be talking later. Aaron is a musician, but she had a question for the doctor.
Yeah, I do. Hi.
Hi.
Hi. So does the use or not use of birth control, hormone or birth control, does that affect the beginning time of perimenopause?
Great question.
Yeah. I'll take mine off the air. Thank you.
The science would suggest it doesn't, that the when you're on the birth control pill, the ovary is still using the eggs, if you will, that naturally would otherwise be ovulated and used up over time. And when all those eggs are gone, that's when a woman has her last menstrual period. But there's something called atresia, and this is a condition that's a little bit complex, but essentially what it is within the ovary itself, even while you're taking the birth control pill, the eggs will go through this atresia, and that's kind of a where the egg kind of gets absorbed or where it is utilized, but in a way that it kind of goes away. So the ovary continues to use those eggs. And so whenever you are going to necessarily go through the menopause, you still will. Now, what can happen, however, is while you're on the birth control pill, the symptoms of the perimenopause can be alleviated. So symptoms like hot flushes or vaginal changes, for example, may be not felt by you because you're using the birth control pill, because essentially you're getting a very controlled amount of estrogen and progesterone. In contrast, remember what I said earlier was that the progesterone begins to diminish. So here you are on a type of hormone therapy. We don't call it hormone replacement therapy. It's called oral contraception, but it's a way of getting estrogen and progesterone in a very balanced fashion. So every day you're getting some of these hormones, so those symptoms are alleviated. But again, the science would suggest that it doesn't delay when you would have your natural last menstrual period.
Got it. And it wouldn't bring it on any earlier?
No, not as far as we can tell. It's one of those sciences that is almost impossible to know because you'd have to be clairvoyant. You'd have to be able to look at a woman and say, oh, I know your last menstrual period before she ever starts the birth control pill is at 52, and then see it with the pill whether it's 52 or 50 or 53. You just don't know. There's no test that tells us when a woman is going to have her last menstrual period.
Well, what's up with that?
Well, there have to be some surprises left.
I guess.
Yeah, that brings us back to that more complex question about how much research is going into women's health. You know, and I guess I'll say this, and maybe this is TMI on my part, but I think when it comes to, you know, like childbearing and childbearing age, like that, you know, perimenopause, menopause is something that women with uteruses will all go through. And maybe it's not that big of a deal unless and until you're dealing with the symptoms or you're at the point where you're trying to conceive a child at, which many of the listeners know it's something that I've been trying to do. And so when you're hitting that stage of your cycle is starting to change and you're noticing things changing, you want medical science to say to you, here are the things that's going on. Here's what we can help you predict. You know, here's how we measure what's happening with your body. But it is certainly not a life or death situation. This is more of a, I don't know if you want to say, you know, being able to have a child is maybe a blessing. It's not a right. People might disagree with that. But so I can understand why maybe medical science hasn't spent as much time when there are other more maybe important things such as cancers that affect women's bodies in different ways. But it is an interesting subject to me.
Yeah, I mean, there is certainly a vast array of data around infertility. So there is certainly science going on around how to assist women in getting pregnant and evaluating the ovaries, the uterus, all the organs that are participatory in pregnancy to better understand what might be preventing pregnancy. But as you may know, there are women out there who go through all the different tests and all the science is applied to them, and it's still unclear why they're not getting pregnant. And that certainly happens. But a woman can go to a reproductive endocrinologist or an infertility doctor, and there are ways in which to look at the health of the ovaries. Does it tell you when you're going to have your last menstrual period? No. We don't really know how to document that, if you will. But there are ways to better understand why someone may not be getting pregnant. Definitively, not always, but certainly we can identify women who have blocked tubes or abnormal cavities in their uterus or who are no longer ovulating in a regular way or whose egg quality may be diminished. Those are some of the the information that we can glean to better counsel people and make recommendations about what steps they might take to get pregnant.
Yes, I'm determined I should really do a show specifically on that one of these days, which I will. I guess, you know, the question that kind of comes up for me when thinking about, you know, as you're observing and noticing that the body is changing, and if you're okay with the, I guess, how you're feeling, if you're not experiencing any kind of debilitating hot flushes or, you know, the sleep cycle. I don't know if we kind of talked about the various things that can come up, but I've heard, you know, it's the hot flushes, the sleeping cycle can change, that it can be harder to stay asleep or fall asleep, and different things, you know, that can change within the body. And if it's just a matter of, what's the word I'm looking for? Just the lifestyle. If you know, like the there's a word that my brain isn't picking up on, but it's the quality of life. It's just, if it's just a matter of quality of life, or are there things that women should be thinking of doing? Like, is a hormone treatment important to help the body stay healthy in any way?
That's a great question. And, some of what we're discussing is simply quality of life. If you are having mild hot flushes that really kind of come and go and not particularly distracting to you, then one might say your quality of life is minimally being impacted. In contrast to a woman who is working in an office, for example, who every hour has to change her blouse because she is perspiring so much from these hot flushes that her capacity to work and focus is markedly being negatively impacted. That's a woman whose quality of life is being impacted, but probably her productivity and her reports from her boss, etc. So part of what I do with my patients is really try to establish how much are these symptoms impacting you? How much are they impacting you in terms of your job, your partnership, sex, and your sleep, etc.? And then, for example, if your sleep is being markedly impaired, so a very common lament for women in the perimenopause is they say, oh, I fall asleep like a rock, but I awaken at 2, and then 4, and then 6, and I'm having trouble falling back to sleep, either because the heat of my night sweats are keeping me up, or I'm just unable to fall back to sleep. And sleep deprivation is not healthy for us. It depletes our immune system. It depletes our capacity for clear thinking and memory, for example. So that's a person who, if she is terribly sleep deprived and feeling fatigued, is at risk of falling asleep in the car while driving. This is life threatening potentially. I had a woman the other day who was telling me she was falling asleep driving. This is life threatening. So this is a woman who I really want to assist with in some way to help her sleep improve. So should everyone be taking hormone replacement therapy during this time in their lives? No. It's not necessary. There are changes that are going on in the body that are a natural response to aging. For example, there's some changes in bone density for some people markedly, for others minimally. For others, heart health may be all of a sudden or slowly but surely being impacted by the aging process, and we think somewhat by the depletion of hormones. Those individuals who are at risk for heart disease, we might want to talk to them more about making sure their exercise regimen is really strong, making sure that their cholesterol is low, making sure they're seeing a cardiologist, making sure that their heart health is being maintained as best as possible. And at one time, we used to recommend hormone replacement therapy for it. Now we know it's actually not the best treatment for heart health. So it really depends on, again, I know this sounds very confusing, but it's a very individual journey. There are some common commonalities that women have. You know, most women experience a hot flush during their perimenopause or into their postmenopausal years. But I've had women who said, I had one. And then I have women who say, I flush every half hour. So it is so variable. But is there one thing or are there things that women should be doing absolutely to maintain health? Yes, but they're not so much about the perimenopause or menopause. They're about overall health. That's stress reduction, exercise, eating well, focusing on good relationships, building community. For example, these are ways in which to promote health. And it's interesting because there was just an article in the New York Times, and I apologize, I don't remember who the author was, but it was a woman describing how there are cultures across the world that don't even have words, literally words in their language, that describe the perimenopause, that describe the postmenopause. There are, of course, women who age and who have no menstrual cycles, but there isn't this phenomenon, if you will, of symptoms associated with the times in their life. And she went on to talk about how there's cultural impact and perhaps biological impact, depending upon where you live. But it's an interesting conversation about why in some cultures, these symptoms just seem not to exist. Now, maybe women don't talk about them in those cultures. That's a possibility. But there certainly seems to be some cultural variances out there.
I remember, I think I came across that article and I did mean to go back to it because it was very intriguing to think about that, if there is something within our culture that makes it different for women in their experience as the hormones change.
Yeah.
So would it be your advice that that anybody who is experiencing, is at that age where you're noticing, or is at that point in your life where you're noticing that your body is changing because the hormones change, is it important to check in with your doctor, even if it's not creating any quality of life issues? For example, you talk about, you know, bone density, there being a loss of bone density. Are those things that should be proactively, you know, observed, or are you really just following the symptoms and treating them as they come up?
Well, this is the reason we ask women to be seen on an annual basis, so that there isn't too much time, i.e. years, in between seeing them, so that if symptoms are arising, changes are occurring, that we have an opportunity to discuss ways of promoting health. So if a woman starts having irregular periods and she otherwise feels fine, there's no significant change in the cycle, meaning that there's not a lot of heavy bleeding or prolonged bleeding, but just less bleeding, then she probably can wait for her annual to talk about those changes with her gynecologist. The bone changes, the heart health changes, these things don't happen overnight. They happen over years. And so it's not an immediate rush to the doctor. However, certainly if someone like Linda were out there and is really suffering, then absolutely don't wait for your annual. Make an appointment for what we call a problem visit and have an opportunity to discuss those changes and ways in which we might assist in ameliorating those symptoms and promote bone health and promote good heart health. Yes.
Wonderful. Well, I don't think that I have any more questions. I mean, I guess the one thing that maybe just to kind of reiterate or close the loop on it is that there are things that you're suggesting are important for people to do for overall health, which can help the quality of life and some of these symptoms. It doesn't have to be hormone replacement therapy. It might be through diet, exercise, things of that nature. Am I correct in that understanding?
Absolutely.
Okay. Anything else, doctor, that you feel like we may have left out? Anything that comes up with any of your patients that is popping into mind on this specific subject that you want to share with anyone?
Only that I'm so glad we're discussing it on the radio, because even though it may be a subject matter that, of course, I deal with every day and you may be thinking about, that there are many, many women out there who still do not understand, know about, are intimidated by this transitional time in their lives. And because we're living longer lives, the majority of women are experiencing this perimenopausal transition into that postmenopausal time frame. And so there are many, many books to be read that give information about this time in women's lives. And certainly your gynecologist should be well-versed in discussing it. But talk to each other, talk to other women, hear what women have to say. And although there can be a focus on social media on the negative aspects of this transition, there can be some really gentle, wonderful changes as well. So, for example, a woman who may have a history of really difficult periods, she celebrates the last menstrual period. She's ready for that to end. And so it's not all kind of gloom and doom. It is a change. As I say to women, aging is never easy, but the alternative, most of us are not interested in throughout our lives. We want to live. We want to prosper. We want to transition as gently and with gratitude as best as we can. But certainly, if those transitional times are difficult, talk to other women. See what they're doing. Talk to your physician and read, because there's a lot of information out there, some of which can be confusing, of course. But if you can write your questions down so that when you walk into your doctor's office, you can say, this is what I'm confused about, you know, what is the science, what is your experience, and how can you help me? That can streamline a visit and assist in getting help sooner than later.
That's very helpful information. And I also want to just reiterate the gratitude for you to talk about this on the air. I think that in addition to just the physical elements that we're facing as you go through a change like this, I think there's also this an emotional and a kind of a spiritual element to the transition that in our culture specifically has been kind of lost. And I see in some circles how people are starting to celebrate the transition from one cycle of womanhood into the next. And maybe with more of that and more conversation, it is something that can be really celebrated.
I agree.
Thank you so much, Dr. Novat. She will be back again. I think we have a date picked in November, but just stay tuned for all of that information to take more of your questions. And we are going to pause here for some more announcements, and we'll be back with my conversation with Erin Dyer. Yeah. That was the song Derby by Buick and Gase, which is a collaboration between Aaron Dyer, who is sitting in the studio with me, and Aaron Sanchez.
Yep.
Thank you, Aaron, for being here.
Thanks for having me here.
I'm going to share a little bit of Aaron's official background, which you can find on her website, which is Aaron, AaronEDYER.com. But Aaron is a vocalist, a multi-instrumentalist, a composer, and a founding member of the band Buick and Gase that I just mentioned, Mistresses, as well as the composer and director of Drone Choir, which is something that is she's going to be performing with at the O Positive Festival that I mentioned earlier in the show at the beginning. And Drone Choir, we'll get into that later, into the details of Drone Choir. But in addition to her own projects, she has made appearances on the National's 2018 Grammy-winning release Sleep Well, Beast, creating and singing the introduction to their number one Billboard hit, The System Only Dreams in Total Darkness. She's collaborated with many other artists that I won't all name here in this introduction, but I am very honored that she made her way down to Kingston to sit and chat with me. And I thought maybe we would start with some real simple, basic questions. Just to kind of introduce you to anyone who hasn't heard of you yet. But things like, where are you from, Aaron?
I'm an omnivore. I grew up in Minnesota.
Where?
Until I started out in Willmar, Minnesota. And then I went to Minneapolis, Minnesota. And
where's Willmar?
Why does that matter? No.
Well,
Willmar
I'm
is
from
a small town. Oh, wait, really? Yeah.
I'm from Wisconsin.
Oh, hey.
So it's a morbid curiosity as to where it's related
It's my trigger. it is 2 hours west of the Twin Cities.
Okay.
A small town, which actually it's not that small town, but it feels incredibly small. So there, then to Minneapolis, where I went to arts high school. And then when I was around 19... I don't remember. Anyways, 19, moved to New York City and was there until 2012.
And you made the great migration north.
And I moved up to Hudson. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's my migration story.
what was your family like? Do you have siblings?
I have an older sister who lives in Seattle. So both of us just exploded away from the Midwest to opposite sides of the country, which is tough because we are very close. And my mother and father live on different lakes in Minnesota.
Lakes. Do you go back to visit ever?
I haven't been back to that area for about 2 years. I often come through on tour, and I kind of consider that a part of visiting.
Yeah.
But... No, I haven't been back for a little while. My mom's not so happy about that. Sorry, Mom.
Does she come out to visit you here at all?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, she's coming out. Actually, both her and my sister are coming out really soon for a Drone Choir.
Oh, cool.
I mean, not specifically for it, but they're going to be there for it,
good
which
timing.
I'm really excited about.
Yeah. That's awesome. So when you think about your childhood, do you have memories of when music kind of came into your life?
Maybe I don't remember this so much as I remember seeing videos of it, because my dad was an avid documentarist. Is that the right way to say that? Anyways, but he would film me singing all the time. To the point where it's like, all right, Aaron, that's enough. That's so nice.
What kind of things did you sing?
I sang about my cats.
So you made up.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. It was all just like stream of conscious child, 3-year-old or whatever. So I was singing really early. And then my dad is a guitarist and also, I don't know what else. My sister played piano. So, of course, I wanted to learn how to play piano because she's older and everything she does is amazing. And Yeah, so I learned how to play piano, and then I wanted to be in band, in the drumming section, the percussion section. So I did that.
How old were you when you joined band? What grade did you do that in?
Well, that's like, I don't know.
Fifth
that was
grade,
like,
six, no,
yeah,
six.
Third is now, I don't know. Whatever time it was forced upon children at that time.
Yeah.
Which is great. Too bad I hear they don't do that so much anymore. But then my dad gave me a guitar when I was 11. And that pretty much catapulted me into staying in my room all the time and, like, sleeping with the guitar, hugging it, and then learning how to play it.
So your dad was a guitar player?
Yes.
Was he how was that involved in his life? Was it something that he did regularly? Was he a musician?
Every day.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. He was not in a band or anything like that when I was growing up, but he had been in a band and he talked very lovingly of it. And he would bring me to concerts. Like, he brought me to see King Crimson when I was something, I don't know, 15, I think. That was amazing.
Yeah. Did he help you learn the guitar at all? Or was
he
it
taught
something?
Me seven chords, and then he got me books upon books upon books about, like, how to read tab, and, like, here's a songbook. And I don't remember I'm sure he had offered to get me guitar lessons, or I'm sure he'd asked me if I wanted them, but I was really avidly against taking guitar lessons, which I kick myself about now. If there are young people who are learning instruments right now or listening right now, just, like, take the lessons, learn the theory. It's so useful. But
That's an interesting, I guess, question. I've had conversations with people who have music theory and they've learned it. Actually, the person that's coming to mind is a friend's son who has studied, I think he studied violin, and it's, like, very particular perfection, everything. But then it becomes difficult to then step out of that and to launch into more of a creative flow and exploration, feeling like you can make mistakes and do things. And knowing what I know a little bit about your creative process, specifically with Buch and Gase, but maybe in other realms, is maybe because you learned organically on your own, it allowed you to be very creative.
I mean, you could say that, but I also learned how to be, how to improvise. And I learned how to listen to someone else play. And that's not necessarily something you can... there's probably books about it, but, like, and just as I could probably learn guitar theory now, it would be harder, but it's, like, you know, it's still a process that you have to go through of, like, learning how to listen to another musician and respond and react in time.
Okay, so I'm gonna bookmark that question about learning how to improvise.
Okay.
But I'm curious to know just if there... When you talk about wishing that you had taken formal guitar lessons as a younger person, is there a reason? I mean, is there something that you feel like you're lacking in your skills?
Oh, totally. I feel like I'm not. I don't feel like I can say I'm a guitarist at all. And I look at other people who are guitarists. And I'm like, yeah.
Like Steve Vai. No, yeah. I'm just kidding.
I certainly can't do Steve Vai. And, like, yeah, I just don't. I don't know how to shred. And by shredding, I think of, like, anyways, you can quote me on that. sure, I shred in other ways. Let me just feel proud about that for a second.
Yes.
Okay, that was enough. But, like, yeah, those are, you know, something that I would like to do is to be able to improvise and sound cohesive if I were doing that on guitar. Whereas, like, the last line in the song that you just played is like, bam, 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 do, do. That's me playing the Buch and just, like, I don't know where I'm going. It's going somewhere. But
we like where it went, Erin.
It went somewhere. Well, anyway.
Okay, so following your creative path, your trajectory, you went to art school.
Yeah.
Were you in bands at that time? What were you doing as far as your creative process?
I was very, I guess I had been in a band. I was in a band when I was in, ninth or 10th grade or something like that. No, 7th. I was in a band in 7th grade.
Did the band have a name?
I don't think I'm going to say that online. Anyways, that's for me.
Who was in the band?
These guys that were in my circle. One of them played drums, the other one played bass, and I played guitar. And it was like, we tried to learn, Smashing Pumpkins songs and Nirvana and like.
Right on.
Yeah. That's what we did. Mm-hmm. And then I think I wrote a song and they're like, well, it's really good. And then I left the band.
Why?
Because the dynamic just wasn't working. I was a kid. They were all
well,
kids.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting thing to think about. Like, I left the band, when I'm in 7th grade.
It was very, I knew what I wanted. I knew what I wanted to do. And that was just basically write songs and play them by myself and be huge by like Ani DiFranco or something like that.
Yeah. Excellent.
Yeah.
So then you left the band.
When I left the band and I went my own 12. Way. I was probably 13 or 14 by that time.
And when you went to art school. In high school in Minneapolis. What were you doing in art school? Was it music?
Yes. Okay. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that was amazing. It was a really great school, Golden Valley Arts High School. I think it's now called Perpich, Lola and Rudy Perpich Center for Arts Education. So many words. We just call it Arts High in Minneapolis. And it's a great school. It's a magnet school, so it attracted kids from all over the state. I was just past the 100-mile mark, so I could stay at the dormitory during weekends, which is amazing.
Fun, yeah.
So I basically left home at 15 to live in a dormitory, true. But then I never moved home after that. When I was 18, I somehow, like during high school, there were people who would come to the school who were going to another school called Music Tech. And this one person came through and was like, I'm looking for an artist to represent. I was like, well, I need representation. And basically through time, she ended up getting me shows. She submitted my tape, because I made a cassette tape, to Lilith Fair in 98 without telling me about it. But when she told me, I was like, oh, that's cool. Okay, I didn't even think about doing that. And they selected my tape, and then I did an audition, and then I ended up opening for Lilith Fair, 98, Minneapolis, which is really huge at the time.
That's very huge.
And huge for an 18-year-old.
Yeah.
And I think that was a really cool thing that they did.
Were you...
looking for locals, I guess.
Were you nervous at all doing something like that?
That was the first time I had been nervous. Otherwise, I had kind of a don't give a hoot. Mm-hmm. Attitude for being on stage, or I really enjoy it, and I really do. It's like my most real self, I think. Like, even talking in front of people, I have a hard time being me. So
is it because you're on stage, or is it because you're making music? I mean, is it both?
Maybe I guess just I don't know. Interacting with people the way that I feel the most comfortable being myself, I guess. I don't know.
So after Lilith Fair, I mean, that must have felt like a big, hey, I'm going places. What happened?
Then what happened? Well, then I got carpal tunnel. So I had a job at a parking ramp where I was swiping tickets. I think, you know, 2020 hindsight, it was a lot of that. And then playing guitar nonstop, you know, in the booth. No matter what the temperature was. And then playing, I wasn't taking very good care of myself at that time. I drank too much. I stopped smoking at that point. But, yeah, so I got carpal tunnel. I basically had to stop playing guitar, which threw me for a huge loop. And I retreated and, like, tried to make music in other ways. So I had a four-track reel-to-reel player recording thing, Sony four-track. And so I would, like, play around with basically creating tracks, which I wouldn't say I was very good at, but it was an attempt. And then trying to perform with that, which was really weird at that time because it was like, you get on stage and you're not playing an instrument. You're just like pushing play on something. That's really weird. It's super strange.
Well, I would think especially
98 or 99.
Right. And for somebody who's used to having an instrument, I mean, that yeah. would be like naked.
Yeah.
Almost.
It's really uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. So when you like had this moment of realization that you couldn't play the guitar, I mean, did you go through any kind of emotional, like I can imagine being thrown into a mild depression.
Huge. Okay. Yeah, no, I basically took that as a sign that I needed to leave. So I fled to New York City where I was like, yeah, nobody knows I'm a musician here. I can be whoever I want. But of course, the first thing I would say to somebody is, I play music. What do you do? You know? And so I couldn't get away from it, even if I thought that that's what I wanted to do. And within the first year, I met Aaron Sanchez. And like, we hit it off. Of course, it was great. Of course, we were introduced because we both had the name Aaron and we both played music. And of course, we would get along. So then he and I started making music, and it was really relieving because I didn't have to play the guitar. I still came up with, like, song ideas on the guitar. I just didn't have to play it all the time, which was great. And then he and I would just do more producing together because he had a background in more, like, electronic music. I don't know if he would call it techno, but just electronic.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
What year was that when you first met Aaron?
2000.
Okay. So that's a long relationship, music relationship.
Yeah, certainly. Huge.
This, I don't know, this is kind of a big question, but, you know, any kind of collaboration can be difficult, you know, whether it's a romantic relationship, a friendship, a work, coworkers, you know, in many different ways. And I'm wondering if you have any kind of wisdom as to how you've been able to stay collaborative with somebody like that.
I don't know if it's wisdom. I think that both Aaron and I are just incredibly stubborn. and we've stuck with each other for a really long time, you know, with a short hiatus. But it's so hard to find somebody that you can be as much yourself and as much open to what you could also be with, and feel that same kind of reciprocation. I think we do that really well musically. But like everything, it's not easy.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the song Define by Mistresses, which is Aaron Dyer's collaboration with drummer Ryan Oslance. Am I saying his name?
Oslance.
And so that's another one of Aaron's musical collaborations. And we've touched a little bit on Buick and Gase and your how you met Aaron Sanchez. Mm-hmm. We'll probably get into a little bit more about how you work together creatively, because it's a subject that I'm a little bit fascinated about. But I'm curious about Mistresses. Like, how did that happen?
Ryan Oslance is also in a band called Luchatistas, and they're based in Asheville, North Carolina. And Aaron and I, as Buick and Gase, had gone on tour with them, I think in 2010 or 11, or I don't really remember, maybe 13. Wow, I'd have to look that up, actually. So we went on tour and just got along. Ryan's a really great drummer, and they would always want to have some kind of jam at the end of the night, at the end of a show, which I was like, okay, I guess. I'll get on stage. Because, like, I don't shred, but Shane shreds. Shane is a shredder. He's the guitarist of Luchatistas. That's a duo, so two duos. Anyways, and then Ryan and I started playing music because he came up to just kind of, for lack of a better word, I really just don't like this word, jam. I just don't like it, and I wish there was a better word. If somebody knows, oh, we could shed. Maybe we shed. But that's a different thing. Anyways, you're like woodshedding something. Anyways, so we got together, and then Aaron didn't make it to the practice or to the playtime. Musician's playtime.
That's a good alternative.
So Ryan and I were left in this room having our own private musician's playtime, which was fine, and it was fun, and we ended up like writing basically a whole album in whatever time we took there. It was really fun. It was so, and it's such a different, you know, dynamic between Ryan and I and Aaron and I, and like, it felt super liberating. So, so we've made kind of a point to like put out an EP and like make sure that we record our music, and it's taken years to kind of get around to, because he's in Asheville, I'm in Hudson, you know, like the only time, there was maybe a year, I mean, I guess in 2 years, we had only actually played together for the total of like 4 days. Like, actually played music together in a room.
Yeah.
And anyways, there's no real way to do it outside of that. So, yeah.
And
so
have you performed as Mistresses?
We have, yeah, a bunch. We've gone on tour twice-ish. Very, like, short, kind of short, haphazard tours.
And would you say that the creative process is similar in how you're working with these two gentlemen?
Yes and no. So working with Aaron, we improvise, we record everything to computer. Can't say to tape. But we record everything as we're improvising it, and we re-record it high fidelity. And so we try to get the best quality out of our improvisations. And with Ryan, I'm just pushing play or, like, record on my iPhone or whatever the heck. And I don't have any other way to record us to remember things. So he and I have to, like, meet somewhere and pay somebody to record us and then pay somebody to mix it. And, I mean, I'd like to learn a little bit more about mixing than I already do. And I certainly have learned a lot working with Aaron, but I wouldn't say I feel confident to do it by myself. So, yeah, so that's where the difference is like in actually having something to show for our musical time.
So I guess it might say it's like, I mean, that's a fairly traditional way of making an album, is you kind of work on the songs together and then you go into a studio and you record it, whereas Buick and Gase is more of a, it's a different process, that's right?
Very different. And, like, yeah, ideally we're both in the room at the same time for the entire process, but that doesn't always happen. Aaron puts in a lot more time on editing and mixing than I do.
Can I ask the question now about learning how to improvise?
Oh, yeah. When Aaron and I first started making music together in 2000, I would basically bring like some song ideas, as I had been since I was 10 or 11, writing songs, complete start to finish. I have all the lyrics, I have the first chorus, I have a bridge, and then I put it together. And I have a pretty good idea of how I want it to sound. So when he and I started musicians playtiming, it would basically be my tracks that he would produce and turn into something that sounded more like something he would make, which is great. I mean, it was basically a mixture of our two egos which brings us into improvising, which Aaron and I discovered over 16 years, over the process of 16 years or something like that, that was not the most ideal way for us to make music together, because it was, there's so much conflict in your ego and working your ego around someone else's ego and then accepting their ego and accepting your own. Anyways, so the best way for us to do it is to just improvise. And it's neither one. It's nobody's at that point. So you have like, you have less ownership, and therefore it's like easier to just play with it. And yeah, not stick too heavily, not like focus too heavily on the keeping of one part or not. It just is what it is. Like when it comes out of Aaron and I, like this in our improvisations, like in Scholars, which is mostly, and I think there's just one, there's maybe, oh, one, two songs that were not necessarily improvised as they are on the recording, but. Oh, I lost my train of thought.
Well, no, it's okay. Just enraptured. I'm fascinated by this idea of improvising, because it's not something that I think most humans are practiced in or even wanting to do. Maybe if you're in a creative art form of some sort, you understand that.
We're improvising right now.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
But it is, there is this element of, do I come prepared with all the questions written out and know exactly, have researched everything and do all this? Or do I step into the flow and just try to be engaged in a conversation? And I've done shows both ways. And I don't know if there is one way that's better over the other. I do know that if I send questions in advance, that sometimes it can feel too scripted, mm-hmm. and then it feels uncomfortable. Like, well, this question is going to be coming, so I've got to be ready. And I know I have that answer prepared, so I've got to fit that in somewhere. And it's not natural. So I tend to fall more in favor with this idea of being in the flow. It's the same way that I kind of try to teach my yoga classes, when rather than having everything prepared, it's like, be in the moment, see who comes to the class, know what the energy of the day is. But you can feel nervous, because mm-hmm. then you're not prepared. I'm using air quotes, mm-hmm. For it. And so that's why it's a bit fascinating to me, this interplay between being in control of everything, having, you know, done all of your research and been, you know, all of the homework, and then you create this thing and then you manicure it and you change it and it's perfected, versus just allowing something to flow.
Well, even with just allowing something to flow, at least in music, I mean, you know, as a musician, you know what your limits are, hopefully. You know what you can do, you know what you can't do. So you come to the table knowing your own abilities, and hopefully you have a familiarity with the other musician that you're working with, even if it's a little bit. Like, I didn't really know what was going to come out of Ryan when he and I started playing. I've heard him, he smashes the drums, and it's just like, he's an animal. He's a total animal. And so I wasn't sure what was going to happen. But like, but I did know how he would hit the drums, at least. I mean, and I don't know. It's just he and I could communicate even verbally about things. So it was easier to, like, come up with music because we can talk. But
I do think that there is so much of our culture, at least in the Western world and in sort of like the patriarchal systems, is of having everything kind of nicely organized within a structure. And so I think it's not something that a lot of people are really practiced in. And I do think, I mean, you and I were talking a little bit earlier when we met up about this idea of the feminine, and the feminine being the creative energy and just allowing creation to exist and not trying to control it too much. And there was an article that I had read about the process of making your last album as Buchan Gase, and how at some point you decided to kind of start over.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it was, there was more of a controlled, maybe contrived, more of an orchestrated attempt at making packages of these songs, mm-hmm. versus the more organic allowing things to just unfold.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
I mean, we certainly, after our release of General Dome in 2012, we were expected to go back into the recording space, writing space, and come out with an album within the year, basically. And we're like, here, well, let's try to hammer this out. And that just backfired on us because we had so many, maybe we were having too many expectations for ourselves, like wanting to have an album that was accessible to listeners. Like, we don't play accessible music. We don't write that. We can't write pop music. We could, but we would hate ourselves.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like, it just feels gross because I don't know what it is. It's just too simple sounding. And I'm a complex person, and I just have more things that would come out of me than a four chord melody or whatever. Anyways, it's
Well, that's a whole other other dynamic, I think, to any creative person, is creating what you want, what makes you happy, versus what sells.
Yeah. Yeah. So we had begun with that, with this follow-up album, by like, okay, well, we got to just do some pop music. How hard can it be? Let's write pop music. And we were improvising and recording, and then re-recording the things that we would improvise and turning it into songs, and like heavily manipulating our parts and the way that they fit together. And in the meantime, we were also doing this thing called Monday Missions, which is basically taking our improvisations, our crappily, is that okay?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. our badly recorded improvising sessions, and just like snippets of them, and like kind of adding some weird sounds to it, kind of adding some ambient sounds or recordings to them. And it would be like a minute long, and we were posting that up on SoundCloud. Like, here, have a snippet of something. Like, as time went on, we discovered that we liked those so much more. And we could never re-record those pieces and have it have the same, like, amazing essence that you could hear on those Monday Missions. Like, anything, we'd take a Monday Mission and we'd turn it into a song, we'd re-record all the parts, and we'd give it another chorus and another verse, and like make it longer, and it would suck. It was just like the energy wasn't there, the mood was totally wrong. So we ended up scrapping that entire album. And which I believe we're at some point going to be releasing tracks of that on our subscription, which I'm just going to plug right now.
You
can go to buchangase.com. We'll take you to a link for our Bandcamp subscription page, where you can subscribe to us and help support us make music. Please.
Please do it. Please.
So we ended up scrapping that, and it nearly broke us up too. Like, we were just fighting over it because it was ego coming in and being like, well, I think it should sound like this. Well, I don't agree with that. That sounds weird. So we scrapped it. We scrapped the entire process, and we just, like Aaron was like, I think what we need to do is just really record our improvisations like we're recording we're in a recording session, just like have the best sounding of all of our instruments and go from there.
I really love that story. I feel like it's a massive metaphor for life in many ways. We're there.
It goes on for a lot longer, so like you can just talk at any time right now.
That was a little sampling of Drone Choir, which is Erin Dyer's musical project that she will be performing with at the upcoming O Positive Festival. She's performing October 12th in the back of BSP in the evening. I want to say like 9:30. I'm trying to find the schedule right now, but I can't find
9 o'clock.
It.
Well, 9:15 on the schedule.
Right, 9:15.
But get there a little earlier, you know? Yeah. We'll see some of this stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So that performance happened at the 2018 Drone Fest.
Correct.
In Basilica, at the Basilica in Hudson, yeah?
Correct.
So where did Drone Choir come from?
I actually started at Basilica Drone Fest in 2015. Melissa Auftemar invited me to be a part of the Drone Fest, and I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. That's such an interesting idea. She's like, you just have to fill up an hour. I'm like, okay. Which I'm really glad she asked me, because this brought me into, a really challenging, really interesting way of working with music for me, and just working with performance. Basically, the first performance I explained the last time I was on this radio station, which was with Jeff Marcel, which was really fun.
Yeah, if you find the O Positive Radio Hour on Radio Kingston, you can hear another interview with Aaron.
Yeah. But a quick rundown is that I basically blindfolded 20 women and gave them directions throughout an hour of what to sing. So individually, I was blindfolded as well, so I wouldn't have any preconceptions over who I was talking to. So I would just start with, like, can you do this? And then I would give them something to do. And if they can do it, then great. I'm going to come back to you in a little bit. You just keep doing that. And then if they couldn't do it, then I would adjust what I gave them to fit their voice. So that was a really interesting exercise, and just like working with other people's voices. Not a lot of them were vocalists to begin with, so they were really exploring their own voice in this process, which was great. Then maybe I should just move on. So then the next time I was asked to do it again. But I didn't want to do the same thing, and I also wanted to have something that was more predictable, because in this first time, I didn't know what I was going to do. I had ideas, but it was basically improvised. And I wanted to have a little more control over the flow of the piece. And then they also gave me a half an hour. So I had to make sure that I wanted to fit everything I wanted to fit into a half an hour. So I started working with Ableton and just basically recording parts. And I was really influenced by a friend, or not influenced, but just I had a muse, which I was really happy to have. So it turned into this, yeah, it turned into like a really kind of social experiment. Because also looking in photographs of the initial drone choir, I was confronted with the fact that it was all white women. And that upset me. So, yeah, I really wanted to make an effort to, because, I mean, the reason why I had to be all women to begin with is because just in the music world, it's been very difficult to be a woman in the music industry. You don't get taken as seriously. You don't get listened to. You are not believed to have any intelligence or knowledge of even electrical, you know, stuff going on a stage or any number of things. So I really wanted to just have a bunch of women on stage and not allow men to be into that, to be in that space, as a, I guess, as a protest, or not even as a protest, just like wanting to change something. So in the same breath, I wanted it also to be racially diverse. I wanted it to apply to, like, I wanted the diversity of the choir to represent the community. And it's really hard to do that. I've had, I've done maybe 19 of these choirs now. And it's really difficult to find diversity. And one reason is because if I have a person who I ask if they want to be in it, and then they say yes, I say, do you have anybody that you would like to invite? Chances are they'll invite somebody who's very similar to them, who's in their same circle, who they think would really enjoy it. And it's true that, you know, not everybody likes this kind of music, and that's fine. But I also want to try to share the experience with as many different people as possible. So in the drone choir roll calls, I ask them to invite people that do not look like them, that are not their age, and I'd even like to extend it to people who have disabilities, even like hard of hearing, deaf, mute. I would love to work with somebody who is like that, who has that as an experience, and see how I can make this choir that enveloping, because it's more than just the song. It's like the song is kind of the carrier of the intent that I really want, which is interaction. And you know, being on stage is very different than standing in front of one person and having a conversation. And so the choir is really, it's an incredibly vulnerable thing for me. And I'm constantly uncomfortable with it.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. That's an interesting, I guess, reality to think about, why you continue to do something that makes you feel uncomfortable. You know, I mean, that's a testament to maybe your own desire to evolve and grow. And or maybe there's just this knowing that it's important. I mean, I personally think that creating sound with other people is, from a spiritual perspective, it's how we get back to that idea that we're all connected. We're all one, right?
Yeah.
And so for many people who don't have that experience, it can be extremely profound.
Yeah.
And so sometimes just knowing that something has to be done helps you move through the discomfort. But you use the language comfort, discomfort in your description of drone choir, both from a performer perspective and maybe audience perspective. Yeah. And I wonder if that's a theme that kind of is in your awareness.
Absolutely. I don't want to say I go out of my way to try to make it an uncomfortable experience, but I definitely want to challenge people's barriers. I want to challenge the performer's expectations of what they're going to be doing, or how they're expected to perform, or how they're expected to be themselves as a performer. And then audience members, of course, like seeing like an audience is, without them realizing it, they are a part of the performance. And so often, by them not realizing it, they're negating their responsibility to react or to interact. And you see this so often in venues where there are chairs and an audience is sitting and they're expected to be quiet and they turn off their cell phones and, you know, like pay attention. And the paying attention is an audience's expected duty. And that's wonderful, obviously. That's a really great thing. But also, it just leads to this kind of behavior that's like, I'm expected to be fed right now with entertainment. If you don't feed me, I'm going to criticize you because I didn't get what I was expecting, which is entertainment. So with drone choir, it's more trying to shake people a little bit. Be like, no, you can actually be a part of this. And so, it's going to be fun.
How does the audience become a part of drone choir
specifically? I can't tell you that.
Oh, we got to go.
You have to go. You just have to be there and then all of a sudden find yourself in a very interesting situation. And you'll be fine with it, too, at that point. They'll be like, oh, because you've just seen all of these vocalists do things that you didn't expect them to do that probably makes them uncomfortable, too. I mean, it's nothing like there's the level of discomfort is limited to very what's the word? Menial
things. Scale of 1 to 10. It's about a 1.
It's like low discomfort. But it's still like confronting each other or not knowing what you're about to sing, which is a big thing. So the vocalists are given their tracks day of, or maybe the week before the performance. I ask them not to listen to it. On the 12th, I'm going to tell them to listen to it because there's some things that I think might be challenging for people who haven't done it before. And so far, it seems like it's a pretty balanced mix of people, alumni, I like to say, of people who've done it before, and then noobs. I wish there was a better term for that. So it's going to be a mixture of people who are familiar with the setup of drone choir, and then people who are just, they don't know what they're going to get into. So it's a challenge for the participants, the vocalists. And I think that the audience gets that. They sense it. They can see it happening. Like, oh, somebody's singing now, and they didn't seem like they knew that that was going to happen.
I'm so curious, really. I'm very excited to...
I'm really excited about this
one. To see this performance.
Yeah, I'm writing new stuff for it, so I'm, like, really excited that there's going to be some sonic change, because I've been doing kind of the same, give or take, time... and part for like the 19 times. I think it's time to move on to like a new sonic world, but we'll see how it goes.
That's October 12th, folks, if you didn't hear it before.
BSB Kingston.
I can see. front door.
So that was Erin singing along with
Front Door.
We forgot that there was a little bleeper in there.
You need a front door button.
So we improvised in the moment because Erin's so good at that. She was singing with Heather Woods Broderick and Bethany Myers at the People Festival in Berlin last year.
2018.
Yeah. Or what year are we?
Actually, no, you're right. That is still last year. Wow.
I got confused for a minute there.
Yeah, me too.
That was beautiful. So it kind of begs the question of, like, the interviewer is like, what were you writing about? How do you come up? Are your lyrics autobiographical? How do you come up with your lyrics?
Sometimes, I mean, like that one, I just started saying it. And it just kind of turned into those lyrics. I didn't feel like I was purposely writing anything in that song. It was just like, this is what I feel right now. Granted, I was in a relationship at the time. And I sent it to him and I was like, what do you think about this? And he's like, does this
Are
mean
you
something?
Are you
trying
something?
To break up with me by song? I was like, you know, I hadn't actually thought about that. Anyways, we didn't last much longer after that anyways. So it might have been foreseeing things. But otherwise, I do write a dream diary, and I try to keep track of my dreams as much as possible. And
is there a reason that you started doing a dream diary?
I had done it since I remembered dreams. I wrote down a dream, I think I was 9, that was about a king dinosaur, and the other king dinosaur, there was one king dinosaur that was in my bedroom, and he was a really big king dinosaur. He had a crown and everything. And then there was another king dinosaur that was much smaller that was in the backyard, and they were fighting. And I had to kind of be the person that went in between the two of them to, like, relay messages. So, like, I wouldn't have remembered that if I hadn't have written it down.
Right.
Like, my dreams get really detailed, and colors and vibe and conversation and things that happen. Like, now, this last one had to do with cell phones, and I was, like, watching the phone just morph in front of me. The screen was just morphing. I was like, oh, that's unusable. Wonderful.
Yeah, right. You know?
This is really great. But like, somebody has asked me if it, like, oh, so do you what's the word? When you think about your dreams and then you try to analyze them. Analyze your dreams. And when I was younger, I certainly did, maybe in my teens when I was getting into pagan and Wiccan religious stuff, that I thought that that might be helpful for me to understand my dreams. And I just generally found, like, all the books about dreams to be really, I mean, it's so personal. You're not going to have the same, this is my opinion, maybe someone else will disagree, but I don't think that if you had a dream that had the same things that I had in my dream about cell phone morphing, it's not going to mean the same thing. And it's going to be like, it certainly doesn't have anything to do with Freud.
Right. I had read something online, of course, as everything online is accurate and correct, but I read something that it's less about the activity of the dream. It's the emotion that you experience in the dream that your body or your brain is kind of like figuring out how to, it's somehow processing it or dealing with it. And so it's been an interesting thing for me to kind of view dreams through that lens. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's, you know, the whole story, but it was a different perspective on mm-hmm. dreams that I hadn't considered before.
Mine are definitely like dump dreams. Mm-hmm. Like if I see staircases. So I had a recent dream that was like I was trying to get from the ground level to the first floor. I was just in Ireland. And so first floor is this, you know, what we would consider the second level of a building. And I was trying to get from ground level to first floor, and the elevator was packed, and I was just trying to get up any staircase, and all of the staircases were broken, like swirling, spiraling staircases, beautiful, ornate. And it was just, I think that I had seen a broken ladder the day before.
Oh,
it was
yeah.
kind of like that mm-hmm. kind of thing. Yeah. I was like, oh,
I don't need this memory.
Couldn't get up that ladder. So apparently I'm not going to be able to get up to the first floor.
Are there other things that you do, you know, to take care of yourself? Are there things that are important to you?
I exercise.
You do?
Yeah, I exercise. I make a fresh batch of chai as often as possible in the morning, which is like so wonderful and warming and, from scratch. I do that, and I exercise, and I've been practicing yoga, I guess, on my own. I have this like 38-minute Ashtanga thing that I do, and I've been doing that for probably a good 3 years. The first year, it was my goal to do it every day, because you don't need to be in a, you don't need a mat, you don't need anything to do that. So on tour, it was really easy for me to like, this is something I have to do, and it helped so much. I didn't have as many back problems. What else? Exercising. I don't know. I think that the writing is something that I've really struggled with since cell phones, since iPhone especially. And I'm attempting to get back into it. You know, like it's the quick thing to just look at your phone like, oh, I have an idea.
Why don't I look it up?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, as opposed to just writing something about it or taking time in the morning instead of looking at the phone right away, then I write instead. So having the goal of writing down my dreams is really helpful. It just gets me writing.
It's funny. I wrote in my journal this morning saying it's time to get an alarm clock and not use my phone.
Yeah.
So that I don't look at it first thing in
the
morning.
Yeah, don't monitor your sleep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Get the phone away.
Well, I think we're about out of time, even though our...
Oh, wait, we can keep talking. What else? What else? Like, why are you trying to get rid of me?
The clock says 2:58.
Two minutes? Are you tired of talking with me already?
No.
Oh, my God. Ask one of those other questions that you didn't get to real quick.
Do you have a spirit animal?
Oh, no. Oh, I don't... think so. I'm not sure. No.
What do you do?
Human?
For fun.
What do I do for what, fun?
Yeah.
I really love going on hikes, actually. I'm about to go on a hike with a buddy, and that's going to be great. I love hiking, being outside, and playing music.
That we're all grateful for.
And laughing.
Thank you so much, Erin Dyer.
I'm eating food.
For being on the show today.
Being in sunshine.
I wanted to mention the music that we heard again. We heard music from Buke and Gace, from Mistresses, and from Drone Choir, mm-hmm. and from Are you calling it Salty Sunday? Is that
No, it's just me.
Oh, okay.
Just Erin Dyer.
Erin Dyer.
You can say it's from me.
We also heard music from Shauna Falana, as always. And she has a new song coming out October 25th. Go to opositivefestival.org. Check out the schedule. Go to Drone Choir on the 12th. Today's show was engineered by Maddie Bogner. We got a new engineer. Yeah. And I think that's about all. Until next week, friends, love yourself and uplift one another.